Well, indeed, I will more or less close today's session while giving you an overview about two optical surveys for transients, and both are coming from the European side. One was performed in La Silla in Chile, and the other one is performed in La Palma in Spain. Now, the first is a survey which is dedicated to the search for GBR orphan afterglows, and so Ehud has given you all the input on how GBR orphan afterglows might look like. And I want to give you, first of all, the timeline, because this is, I think, an interesting point here. In 1997, the first GBR afterglows were discovered. In 1997 as well, James Rhodes proposed in the existence of orphan afterglows itself. And roughly a bit more than a year later, my former supervisor, Jochen Greiner at MPE in Garching, proposed for a dedicated search for these kind of orphan afterglows in order to be able to constrain, possibly, the collimation of GRBs. Now, we proposed the survey at the 2.2-meter telescope in La Silla, which is a joint MPG and ESO facility, and the observations were indeed performed in 1999. I will tell you later what kind of observations this indeed were. Now, then there was a large gap of nearly 6-7 years now, and last year I decided to just grab the data from Jochen and try to analyze them, look through all junk, and try to identify possible orphan afterglows, and run the whole process until this now in press in astronomy and astrophysics. Now, this is a typical image of the wide-field imager. It consists of 4 × 2 2K by 4K CCDs, the field of view of roughly a quarter of a square degree, with very little loss in gaps here, and a plate scale of 0.23, which is essentially a very nice instrument. It has very few bad columns, so it gives you a very good throughput for a search for these kind of transients. Now, if we wanted to look for orphan afterglows, we were basing our strategy for the search actually on the knowledge of GRB on-axis afterglows. So I'm speaking about the case C of Ehud, where the on-axis afterglow looks pretty similar, or more or less similar in behavior to the normal GRB afterglow. And we base our strategy on the knowledge of GRB afterglows at that point, which is, of course, this is a bit later here, but just to demonstrate, if this is the Arban light curve here in magnitudes over the time, then a typical burst has a power law decay, a break, and a steeper decay. And we wanted to be able to identify an orphan afterglow with as few as possible observations, because if you have to propose at a big telescope, they typically don't give you 100 nights in a row. And so we ask for imaging in imaging with 2 nights difference. So if you observe field, let's say by chance, 1 day after the burst, and another observation 3 days after the burst, most of those pre-swift afterglows, which are indicated here, would be nicely visible in these 2 observations, possibly even in more. And so together with the earlier and later limit on the magnitude, you could get an idea if this was a good orphan afterglow candidate or not. Now at that point, I have to put in our little drawback that we were not planning, or Jochen at that point was not planning to do a spectroscopic follow-up because of various other reasons. However, so our limiting magnitude, this is the gray box here, was 23 magnitudes at the 10 sigma level, which consists roughly of 7 minutes of integration. Now, I show you here to give you an overview where our survey actually lies. This is log area in square arc minutes over limiting magnitude. This is more or less a plot which you see for normal, non-phenomenal surveys which are not focused on variable sources. But just to give you a feeling, so the wide-field imager was rather small in terms of the area which we cover, but similar to the faint sky variability survey, which is the second survey I will speak about later, and also pretty similar to the DLS, which we heard just some seconds before. Now, we observed 7 southern fields, which were separated in 2 to 8 subfields, covering roughly 12 square degrees, and each of those fields was observed between 11 and 25 nights. depending on the weather conditions, because we had roughly a loss of 25% of the whole observations. And if you can imagine, if you have this kind of strategy where you observe every second night and one of those nights gets lost, and you have a gap of four or even six nights, then identifying a possible candidate over several nights becomes more or less more difficult and difficult. Now what you see here is the actually observing schedule, which is the distance in time between two observations of a given field. And if we would have followed our strong strategy of just having every two nights one image, all the observations would be here at 2 days. So you see we have some observations where we observed a given field several times in the night, some one night after the burst, but also several where we were not able to keep our strategy and had to go on the field later. Now the data are roughly 700 images, 130 gigabytes, so a small amount essentially. And we performed chip-by-chip data reduction based on a simple Perl IRF and WiFix pipeline. And looked in the first place just for transients based on the variation or the difference of their typical of their brightness at one point with respect to their differential light curve or mean differential light curve. So whenever an event was brighter by 3/4 of a magnitude than in the mean light curve, reflected as a possible candidate, which turned out to be not very stringent. So we had 12,000 candidates in that small field. But after a lot of overnight screening and verification and filtering, it turned out that we had actually four transient sources which were detected in more than two observations with a certain confidence. And three of those is you're seeing here, where you see the light curve in the R-band over the seeing evolution at the same point. And the first one shows probably behavior of a binary system, maybe a CV. The third one rises by a bit more than two magnitudes over course of, well, between the two observations, and then shows either a long decline or maybe so even some kind of oscillation here. This is the drawback if you're missing observation due to bad weather, then you can't fill the gap in here, and so you cannot really constrain how the source was actually behaving at that point. Or it could be possibly a dwarf novae or similar. Now this third one here, this is more candidate for a flare star. It was pretty faint, 22.5 early on, and then rises and decays within a couple of minutes. This is essentially, you said 100 seconds, no, 20 seconds to 60. So, no, sorry, 20 minutes. So it decayed pretty quickly. Oh, it is a possible candidate for a flare star, although this were R-band observations, so it might not be as we heard before, which is probably better for flare stars. Now, the fourth candidate, and this is something we're dedicated a single slide to, was probably the one which fascinated me in the beginning most. You see the light curve, faint, 21.3 at the early time of this survey. And then it arose within a bit more than, well, between the 2 days, by 1.5 magnitude. And unfortunately, again, we missed later observations due to the bad weather situation and due to the scheduling in general. Well, this doesn't look very promising if you want to look for an off and afterglow. However, if you take a look at the image here on the right side, this is a star which happened to be in the neighborhood of the source. Then you will see, if we overlay the early time observation with the flaring observation, that this candidate was a little bit offset by roughly 0.6 arc seconds. Now there's, okay.
Is that 1.5 magnitude increase in plots relative to that stellar source relative to the background level?
That is relative to the stellar source. So if, yes, this certainly the increase here is certainly only a lower limit on the real increase in brightness. Sure.
So are those brightnesses measured in apertures? So I guess if it's offset from the source, you can't do PSF photometry. Right?
Well, yeah, this is actually PSF photometry.
But if the source is offset from, if the transient is offset from the source,
maybe a new source, like another planet.
Yeah, sure. That's one of the possible explanations. I don't Well, there are several explanations, of course. It could be flare star, which is oval M, which is by chance coincidence in front of this. Or, well, if this is a background source and this would be a flare star, would be possible. Could be a supernova, although the increase, I think, is a bit steep for that. Could be an orphan afterglow, could be also an asteroid, KBO, minor planet. However, there was, from the four candidates which we had, probably one of the most promising. Unfortunately, this event is 7 years ago, so there's certainly no real way to verify this except taking a spectrum of the underlying source and identifying if this is a galaxy, which would increase the possibility that this is indeed an interesting source or not. Now, if you perform such a survey, you're interested in how efficient is your survey for, in my case, orphan afterglow detections. And what I did here was performing Monte Carlo simulations, producing a number of randomly distributed in time and space GRB afterglows following a typical GRB, detected GRB afterglow. So pre-break slope, break time, and post-break slope. These are essentially values and distributions taken from real data of pre-Swift burst. And if you try to identify how many events or what's the detection probability to detect one of those randomly distributed events at a given magnitude in your survey, then the most important parameter is actually the initial brightness with which this event starts in your survey. And this is not very well constrained from the data, unfortunately. So I show you here the probability over the limiting brightness for three different models. One is a constant distribution of initial brightness between 9 and 20, one between 13 and 23, and another one which increases with decreasing magnitude between 13 and 23, which is the solid black line here. So what you see for our survey turned out that if we want to have a solid afterglow detection, or the probability would be high for one solid afterglow detection, we would have required of the order of 3 times 10 to the 7 burst per year in full sky for first detection. And if we follow our criteria of having two detections, that goes even down. The other way around. This was 6 times 10 to the 7, 10 to the 7 burst per year. Now one can play the game and try to see if one can at least get a rough estimate on the GRB collimation. So essentially not on the ratio of GRBs which we see by the prompt emission and GRBs which we don't, but more by the ratio of the gamma emitting region and the optically emitting region. So the on-axis GRB off and afterglows in that case. So if we assume that the number of events which require for one detection where we actually did have non-detection gives you a good upper limit, and the number of long-duration GRBs can be taken from both the values, for instance, of Betsy of the number of observed long-duration GRBs, then we have, which we need to correct for several correction factors, including how many X-ray flashes, X-ray rich bursts Betsy probably did not see, what's the fraction of optical dim dark bursts, which we would definitely miss in the survey. And also, if there might be a contamination by optical transients of short bursts, although these correction factors are pretty low. However, if you do all the numbers, it turns out that the ratio of optically to gamma-ray emitting regions, which we can constrain from the survey, is very high, which is, of course, if you know the literature, significantly larger than the ratio of the beaming fraction, which was obtained, theoretically, and also observationally by Guetta, Freyldal, which is more of the order 75 to 500. So what is the outcome of the whole story? Essentially that one needs a significantly larger sky coverage, which we had, so 12 square degrees were by far not enough. And so if I use the same code for making the simulations and tested our strategy, so two observations every night over 150 nights, if you get this continuously running, and monitor 50 square degrees, then you're already in the range of the beaming correction here. If you have even larger areas, which are certainly possible, then you might constrain this down to a factor to roughly 10 in terms of the beaming collimation fraction. Now, the second survey, this is something where I'm not involved personally. I was just having the opportunity to speak to two people who are now heavily involved in pushing out the results of the faint sky variability survey, which was performed in La Palma, which is a 2.5-meter telescope. It's the Isaac Newton telescope. I think Ed van den Heuvel should be the PI of that, or at least that's written on the web page.
Yes, but it's mostly a grandstand for the monuments.
Yeah, yeah.
it was conceived by our fathers. Yeah. Also, he initiated that. When he died, people asked me to take over just for the monuments. But the guy who was really doing it is Groot in
Frankrijk. Yeah, indeed. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the survey was obtained in on a longer time scale, but started roughly at the same as our survey between 1998 and 2001. You see here a cutoff of the camera, which is essentially a 2K by 4K CCD system with an L shape. So you'll miss a little bit of the roughly ninth of the field of view due to the gap here. The plate scale is larger by a factor of 1.5 than our survey was. But most of the data, or if you're interested in how the data reduction and most of the analysis went on, just take a look at the paper of Groot, which writes this in detail. Now, the aim of the survey was following the name already, less on transients in general, but mainly on variability. So it was the idea was to measure photometric and astrometric variability in a very until V24 and time scales between several minutes and several days together with the yearly observations in order to get the astrometric variability correct. In total, they monitored 78 fields at mid and high galactic latitudes, which cover roughly twice the area of our bifield imager survey. And together with the photometric colors and BVNI, they was allowed to get an idea about what a certain source might be. Now, most of the results now, they're coming out exactly right now, so very good timing of the workshop, or better, very good timing of the paper here, were published by Morales Rueda from Nijmegen. And I want to show you just a few of those. So first of all, they looked for variable sources, transient sources, that in general, based on the deviation of the individual light curve measurements from the mean source brightness, so the simple approach, which I also use for my white field imager survey. You see here the non-variable sources in the survey, which are roughly 200,000. And if you take a look at the short-time variable sources, you see that they mostly follow the main sequence. So these are color diagrams, V minus V over V minus I. And in color code here, you see the number of variable sources. And if you take a look at the fraction of those short-time variable sources over the number of non-variable sources, you see that most of them, although there seems to be roughly a 1%, so this is a fraction here times 100 in color code, roughly 1% of all the events are variable on short time scales. There seems to be a certain increase in the fraction at the very blue end of the main sequence to roughly 3.5%, and then there are some which are clearly above the main sequence.
And what accuracy level is that?
Accuracy level on the variability, or what do you mean?
You say 1% variable, but is that at the level of 0.01 magnitude or 0.1 or what level?
This is the 5 sigma variability, so depending on the brightness of the event.
What's typical?
Well, the bright sources, they have accuracy up to millimagnitudes for the painter sources. They go, of course, a bit less accurate. Now, the second way was to use to take a look at the amplitude and time scale of some of those sources by using a floating mean paradigm, which assumes a sinusoidal variability but allows to obtain the amplitude and the time scale for these events. It depends on the ratio of magnitude or amplitude of the variability over the uncertainty and the magnitude, as well as in the number of observations, of course. What you can see here is the number of square degrees and color code for which a given maximum reconstructed period could be obtained depending on the amplitude of, or the ratio of the amplitude and the variability and the uncertainty and the variability. And so for typical periods of five hours, mainly most of the survey area around 17 square degrees could be very well reconstructed. So these were simulations of the time schedule which was obtained for the survey. Now, using this method, they could classify and phase convolve several objects, or light curves of several objects. For instance, one of the RRLIR candidates, but this is the light curve in V, and this is the phase fold light curve, which gives a periodicity of roughly, I think, 6.5 hours. And the second one, which is a sub-dwarf B candidate, with a few data points in the light curve, but also with a very nice phase folded light curve of the order of 4.2 hours, I think. Now, the last part here is the distribution of the time scale and the amplitude, which they obtained for 219 of those total 200,000 sources, for which the error on the amplitude was, and the error on the error on the amplitude and the error on the periodicity is less than 10%. What you see here is the number of variables over the period. So most of those variable sources are indeed very shortly variable. And if you zoom into this diagram here, you see that there might be even a hint of a bimodal distribution in that, peaking at roughly 43 minutes and 2.9 hours here. And if you take a look at the amplitude distribution, then of course as well here, as you expect, most of the variability comes at low amplitudes, and only a few of those sources were sinusoidal variable at more than 0.5 magnitudes. And so let me put up the summary, so just briefly give you the overview in this one slide. So the Placia survey, that was the work which I did as one of the things during my PhD, was focused on orphan afterglows. We ended up with having a non-detection, if we are honest, but it was showing that our strategy, if we apply this to a larger survey, might very well easily be followed to the detection of the real first orphan afterglows, assuming an on-axis scenario. And the La Palma wild faint source variability survey was a similar level in terms of depth, a bit deeper and a bit wider, but it was more focused on timescales and variability in minutes to several days. Unfortunately, I can't tell you much about one-time events here. This is something which Paul Weisweig is writing up right now, but I think there will be something interesting coming out soon on that respect. Thanks.
Define an optical transient,
because
the sources were observed in every epoch. So it's not a true transient.
Okay, we defined this transient based on if there were brightening or if there was a deviation in their mean differential light curve, from the mean differential light curve. So if I have one observation which is significantly brighter than the mean differential light curve, because it did not perform absolute photometry here in that case, then I classified it as a possible candidate of a transient source and looked to it in detail.
And then how do you decide it was a transient source?
Well, first of all, most of those sources were filtered and screened, partially even with long overnight shifts in terms of eye search, where you usually can identify remnants of reflections of bright stars in the system,
and so on. For monotonic decay, so that you see this large amplitude increase in that decay.
Well, I would have identified an orphan afterglow based on that, yes, but we had no such candidates, so I can't.
Can you show again the slide? You have color plots and variability versus color thing.
Yep.
Okay, so what I would have done there is use the stellar locus ridge to extract what are likely to be main sequence stars, and then say plot variability for those. Outliers from there will be combination of quasars, misclassified galaxies, and perhaps errors of measurement. That's why they have both strange color and high variability index. So that'll be a useful thing to separate. Also, since we know how many quasars are there at these magnitude levels,
you could then ask the question, what fraction of variable stellar-like objects outside main sequence locus are likely to be AGNs? You know, is it about the right number, or do you have 10 times as many?
Okay, before we break, I want to